I'll talk to my agent.
Anything else I can do for you? Ryan asked. You've done more than enough, sir. I'll make out fine. With all the pretty doctors and nurses around here, I got no complaints. Ryan laid a hand on the boy's good shoulder. You need anything? I've left a card on the nightstand with my secretary's private number. Okay? Yes, sir. Ryan leaned closer. I'm serious. The boy nodded. Thanks. Ryan stiffened, fighting back the tears welling in his eyes. He snapped his hand to the corner of his eye, the crisp salute he'd learned as a young Marine lieutenant decades ago. The CNO was caught off guard. Senior ranks didn't salute junior ranks, and Ryan was the CNC. But he sure as hell appreciated him doing it, and he joined in. Schaefer was stunned, but he returned the salute smartly with the remains of his left hand. See you at the ballpark, kid, Ryan said with a wink before turning and leaving. Ryan was lost in thought as he and Admiral Talbot made their way across the ward toward the elevators, two Secret Service agents in step behind them. Ryan knew that every time a soldier went into the field on his orders, or under the authority of his office, even if he wasn't aware of the specific mission, he bore the responsibility for the outcome, and he took that responsibility seriously. Sending fragile young bodies into hostile, high-kinetic environments entailed enormous risk, and these magnificent kids willingly accepted that risk, even if they didn't fully understand the real cost until they actually had to pay it. It was his job to make sure they didn't have to pay that cost, or to be damned sure it was worth it when men like Schaefer paid it in full. The longer he was on the job, the more certain Ryan was that it should be the old men that went to war. The young had too much to lose. Ryan didn't notice the admiring stares of the doctors and nurses as he passed by. It was hardly the first time he'd been to the critical care unit, but his obvious compassion for the wounded warriors always made an impact on the staff, who were even more dedicated to their recovery than he was. A private word with you, if I may, Mr. President, the CNO asked as they stepped into the elevator. Of course. Ryan looked toward the senior agent in charge of today's presidential detail, Ruby Knox, herself a former Marine. Meet you in the basement. Yes, sir. Knox spoke into her cuff mic, informing the rest of the detail of the change of plans. She was warned the first day she was assigned to Swordsman by Gary Montgomery, the special agent in charge of the Presidential Protective Division, PPD, otherwise known as the Shift, that she needed to be flexible. This president wasn't about ceremonies and calendars, but instead focused on the task at hand, including today's unscheduled visit to Walter Reed. Normally, Gary would have been the point man on an off-campus visit like this one, but he was on a fly-fishing trip with his daughter in Montana, and the honor fell to her. God, she loved this job. Knox keyed the panel on the security elevator so that it would proceed directly to the basement garage, bypassing the intervening floors. As the stainless steel doors shut behind them, Ryan turned to the Admiral. So, John, what's up? Our people over at MDA, the Maritime Domain Awareness Element of the Office of Naval Intelligence, bumped up a report to my office this morning that needs your attention. You got it. To make a long story short, the Royal Australian Navy received a report of a possible ship sinking in the South Pacific. The Jade Star was a Panamanian-flagged commercial vessel, sunk with all hands on board. The vessel's AIS signal disappeared immediately, which was how they got the call. Talbot didn't have to tell the president, a former CIA analyst and national security advisor, that international maritime law required every vessel over 300 tons to broadcast Class A automatic identification system signals. AIS provided a host of self-reported data, including GPS coordinates, speed, port of destination, and the like, all supported by dozens of AIS-enabled orbiting satellites. I'm sorry to hear it, Ryan said. The cause? Did Sibbers pick up anything? Ryan was referring to SBIRS, the space-based infrared system. No, sir. He explained why Sibbers failed. Ryan understood, but wasn't pleased. But that was a conversation for later. Shit. Ryan rubbed his hand through his hair, thinking through the implications. What do your people suspect happened? The only data we have to go on at the moment is the flotsam the Australians were able to recover from the wreck. A few floating containers. Even fewer corpses. 3, to be exact. Cause of death? Drowning. Trauma. 2 victims had burns. Could be from the cause of the sinking, or from the vessel itself if it caught fire and exploded. No eyewitnesses? No. And no survivors. Talbot continued. The cause remains unknown. Ship sinkings aren't all that unusual. Over the last decade, an average of 100 ships over 100 gross tons are lost every year, mostly through weather, onboard accidents, or human error. The last two options were MDA's first assumption as to cause. Then they started digging around. And, by their count, 6 ships in total have gone down in the last 8 weeks in the area, averaging over 70,000 deadweight tons each. That isn't easily explained. It's obviously a big concern. Ryan frowned. It sure as hell was. 90% of the world's international commerce was transported by nearly 60,000 merchant ships, crewed by over 1 million sailors. A threat to global shipping was a threat to the global economy. Any pattern to the sinkings? Right now, it looks like it's limited to the South Pacific and only commercial cargo vessels. 6 different flags, all different cargoes, none hazardous or environmentally sensitive, at least that we know of. I'll circle back to you with more details when I get them. Ryan's eyes narrowed. Why are we just hearing about this now? The elevator dinged and the doors slid open to the basement garage. The armored Cadillac limo, affectionately known as Stagecoach, stood idling in the distance, flanked by 2 PPD agents still out of earshot. Weighing in at nearly 10 tons, the vehicle featured 5-inch-thick windows, 8-inch-thick doors with electrified handles, and a supply of blood matching Ryan's type among many other survival features. The owners of the vessel reportedly called in to the destination port and said the Jade Star wouldn't be docking there. No explanation given. The weird thing was, they made that call after the explosion. Of course, the port didn't know that at the time. A cover-up. Apparently. One of the MDA techs got curious. She decided to find out what other AIS signals had vanished over the last several weeks, and had also canceled their port arrivals after the fact. More cross-checking showed that 5 other vessels had disappeared in that manner. What do the other shipping owners say happened? That's the weird part. When we contacted them, they refused to respond. A couple of them even denied losing their vessels altogether. That doesn't make any sense. No, sir, it doesn't. So what do you need from me? Turns out one of the ships that went down was leased by White Mountain Logistics and Security. That's Buck Logan's outfit. He's one of the good guys. Took over from his father several years ago. Ryan chuckled. You ever meet Buck's dad, Scooter? No, sir, but I've heard stories. Trust me, they're all true. He was a 6'5", 240-pound lineman for the UT Longhorns, back when they wore leather helmets. Ran an infantry platoon with the 5th Marines in Korea. He came home and built a trucking company that Buck expanded into a worldwide operation. They don't make them like that anymore. So what's the story with Buck? He hasn't been any more cooperative than the other ship owners. In fact, he hasn't responded to any of our inquiries. Given his special status, I was hoping you might have a word with him. If you're asking me to get involved, you must think Buck is hiding something. That's the suspicion. More to the point, we need to know why he's hiding it. And you think he'll tell me? That's a pretty good bet from where I'm standing, sir. Logan had a big GOP fundraiser scheduled next month in Houston, where his company was based. White Mountain Logistics Plus Security was one of the country's largest civilian defense contractors, providing nearly $1 billion worth of transportation and operational support to the DOD every year. In effect, Ryan wrote his paycheck. But if Ryan called Logan and Logan lied, that would put Ryan on the horns of a dilemma. Unless Buck had broken the law, he wasn't compelled to discuss the situation with anybody, including the President of the United States. On the other hand, Why wouldn't he want to talk about it? Buck would have to tell the truth to Ryan if he didn't want to lose his contracts with the federal government. No way he'd spend tax dollars with a known liar. But shutting down White Mountain right now would put a lot of men and women in uniform at risk, and that was something Ryan couldn't abide either. "I'll call him and see what I can find out," Ryan said as he climbed into the armored Cadillac. "I appreciate that, sir. And also, what you did for young Schaefer today. Compared to what he's sacrificed for us, I haven't done a damn thing. Keep me posted on this situation." "Will do, sir." Ryan had been scheduled for a lunch meeting with the Secretary of Agriculture, but he'd bumped it for Schaefer. He'd asked Arnie Van Dam, his chief of staff, to apologize to her and to reschedule for tomorrow. He pulled a protein bar out of his briefcase. It would have to do for his midday meal today. "Where to, sir?" the driver asked. Ryan cracked open one of the bottles of water that were always sitting in the cup holder in front of him. Time enough to grab a quick workout in the White House gym before his 3 o'clock with Senator Burns. "Back to the barn, please. There's a stack of iron calling my name." "Yes, sir." Stagecoach pulled out of the shadows and into the dull light of a gray autumn day. Ryan's heart was heavy with both pride and grief over Schaefer's sacrifice, knowing the battles the boy was now going to have to endure. Over the next several months, he faced a number of corrective surgeries for his face and prosthetic limb fittings, followed by months of painful PT and training. But the bombshell the CNO just dropped in the president's lap was what occupied his mind, spinning with the terrible possibilities. Maybe Buck Logan would have the answers he needed. He pulled out his phone and called Betty Martin, his longtime personal secretary, to place the call to the big Texan. Chapter 9. Barcelona, Spain. United States Consulate. Jack arrived without an appointment when the doors opened at 9 o'clock, which was probably a mistake. A number of people were already queued up for business, mostly Spaniards, according to the passports they displayed at the security check-in. The 3-story beige Mediterranean-style building looked more like a producer's home in Beverly Hills than a federal facility. It felt oddly comforting to know he was standing on a patch of U.S. soil, even though it was smaller than the average Walmart parking lot. He suddenly felt a pang of homesickness, which surprised him. In the lobby, Jack put his name and the purpose of his visit on the waiting list: to report the death of an American citizen. He was promptly moved to the front of the line. After showing his passport to the very pleasant young Spaniard behind the counter, he was given a visitor's tag to wear. She then escorted him to a waiting room on the second floor. Moments later, a middle-aged brunette with green eyes, a kind smile, and sensible shoes approached him. "Mr. Ryan, I'm Debbie Mitchell, the consular officer." Jack shook her hand. "Nice to meet you." She escorted Jack into her small but tidy office and took a seat behind her desktop computer. "Can I get you a coffee or something to drink?" "I'm fine, thanks." "I understand you have some bad news to report." "Yes. A friend of mine, an American citizen, was killed yesterday in the bombing over in the Elborn district. I saw the bombing on the news last night. I didn't realize an American had been killed. No names have been released." "Were you there?" "I had just left." "Thank God you're okay. I'm so sorry for your loss." "Thank you." Mitchell turned to her computer. "Would you mind giving me his or her name?" "Sure. Renee Moore. Renee Michelle Moore, I believe." Mitchell typed in the information. "You wouldn't happen to know her passport or social security number, would you?" "Sorry. Age?" He wasn't exactly sure. Close to his. 30, plus or minus a few, I'd guess. "Race? African American." Mitchell typed a few more keys, then stopped. She frowned at her screen for a moment, then glanced up at Jack, offering an awkward smile. "Mr. Ryan, would you mind waiting here for just a moment?"
"Sure.
If you'll excuse me." Mitchell rose from behind her desk and headed out the door, clearly on a mission. Jack sighed. This was the part he worried about. He wouldn't trade his name for anything in the world, But being the president's son carried a few disadvantages in life, including unwanted attention, especially from U.S. government officials. His folks had done a fantastic job of shielding his identity from the public when he was younger, and both the feds and Hendley Associates had worked miracles, constantly scrubbing the web and almost every public and private database of any kind of reference to him and his siblings, particularly photographs, or any other information that might link him to his famous parents. But sometimes a stray file lingering on a hard drive in some vast server farm had been missed. Nearly 100 million photos and videos were posted just to Instagram every single day. That lingering file could be anything. Someone's uploaded yearbook that he had signed years ago, or a cell phone shot taken when he passed by unawares. It wasn't the intentional posting that worried people. It was the accidental stuff, obscure and unimportant, that interested sleuths might find and exploit to their advantage. Whatever it was, something in Mitchell's computer had sent her scurrying to the Consul General or some other high-ranking official. Moments later, a gentleman appeared in the doorway. "Mr. Ryan," Mitchell said. "This is Mr. Dick Dellinger. He'll be taking over the rest of the interview. If you'll excuse me, it was nice to meet you."
"Igualmente," Jack offered. His middle school Spanish was improving.
Dellinger looked to be in his 40s. He was shorter than Jack by 4 inches and at least 40 pounds lighter. But Dellinger's fierce brown eyes behind the rimless glasses and the knotty biceps beneath his tailored shirt told Jack this was a guy who knew how to handle himself. He shook Jack's hand before perching on the edge of Mitchell's desk, giving him a height advantage over the larger, younger man.
"Mr. Ryan, I'm so sorry to hear about the loss of your friend Renee Moore. What happened?"
"I was already at the restaurant when Renee walked in. We exchanged business cards and planned to get together later for a drink. I left, and moments later the bomb went off. I rushed back in, and she died."
"My God, that's awful.
Any idea who might have done it?"
"A woman I spoke to last night said that Brigada Catalan had claimed responsibility."
"What woman was that?"
"She was with the Spanish CNI.
Dellinger's eyes narrowed.
"So you spoke with Spanish authorities about Ms. Moore?"
"Yeah, why?"
Dellinger shrugged.
"I'm just surprised they haven't contacted us about her, that's all. It's a professional courtesy."
"You talked to anybody else?"
"About Renee? No, just her.
She was on the scene pretty quickly, along with a dozen other uniformed officers from different departments.
Barcelona is a relatively small town, especially in the old city, and the cops here are pretty good. I'm not surprised they showed up like that, especially with everything going on these days."
"Yeah, I've been reading about the protests and the independence movement.
A lot of Americans have canceled their vacations because of the protests."
Dellinger smiled,
a thin line across his clean-shaven face. "I take it you weren't concerned?"
"No, not at all."
"Did Ms. Moore happen to tell you why she was in Barcelona?"
"Not really. My impression was she was in the restaurant to meet somebody."
"For what purpose?"
"She didn't say."
"She didn't tell you who she was meeting?"
Jack felt the heat rising on the back of his neck. At least this wasn't about his dad. But why the hell was he being interrogated?
"No, she didn't."
Jack didn't add, "and she didn't know who it was either."
"Did she tell you what her line of work was?"
"She said she was with a fintech company called Crowdscope out of California."
"So she was here on business?"
"I really don't know. She didn't say."
"And you're here on vacation, I take it?"
"Yeah, I've always wanted to visit this part of the world."
"And what's your line of work, if you don't mind my asking?"
"I was going to ask you the same thing, Mr. Dellinger."
"Fair enough. And please call me Dick."
Dellinger pulled up a chair and sat down across from Jack.
"I'm with the consulate's public diplomacy section. I work with the student exchange programs, university lecture series, you know, the cultural stuff."
Now it was Jack's turn to smile. "Field trips with high school students, wine tasting with the faculty wives, that sort of thing?"
"Pretty much. It's not exciting work, but it's important. Or at least I like to think so."
Bullshit. And they both knew it.
"Now it's your turn, Jack."
"I'm a financial analyst with Hendley Associates. We're based out of Alexandria, Virginia.
He pulled a card out of his wallet and handed it to him. So you were both working in finance?
Yes, I guess so. I actually met Renee at Georgetown. We had a couple of business classes together. She was phenomenal with numbers.
You've known her for several years?
Yeah, but I hadn't seen her since we graduated.
Pretty close with her while in school?
What is it you really want to know, Dick? Dellinger sat back in his chair, tenting his fingers in front of his narrow face.
We take the death of American citizens very seriously. I'm just trying to get all the information I can so that we can be sure that all Americans in Spain can live and travel safely here.
Jack's phone vibrated. Excuse me. He pulled it out of his pocket. It was a text from Brosa. My office, 10 a.m. He checked the time at the top of the screen. He could just make it. He texted back. On my way.
Problem? Dellinger asked.
Jack stood, ending the meeting.
Not at all. Gotta run, Chief.
Jack stuck out his hand as Dellinger stood. He gripped it.
Yeah, the guy could probably handle himself.
Thank you for bringing this information to our attention, Mr. Ryan. I hope the rest of your stay in Barcelona is uneventful. And please, don't hesitate to call me if you need any kind of assistance.
I appreciate it.
Jack turned to leave.
Oh, just one other thing, Jack. Who did you say you met with from CNI?
Jack grinned.
I didn't.
Chapter 10, Washington, D.C.
Mr. President, Buck Logan is on the line for you, his secretary said.
Thanks, Betty. I'll take it from here.
Yes, sir.
She clicked off the line.
One advantage of a heavily armored limo was the near-utter silence inside the cabin. Perfect for calls.
Buck, Jack Ryan here.
Mr. President, it's quite an honor.
How's the weather in your neck of the woods?
Swampy, with yellow rain in the forecast and another shitstorm on the horizon.
Logan laughed.
God, how I hate D.C.
It's not always my favorite place either, but we serve where we're stationed, right?
Yes, sir.
Speaking of which, how can I serve you?
Listen, Buck, I've just had a very disturbing brief from Admiral Talbot.
Talbot's a good sailor. You can trust his judgment.
I do. But let's cut to the chase.
I understand his friends have had a hard time reaching you. They want to have a talk.
There was a pause on the other end of the line. It didn't take an FBI profiler to figure out what that meant.
Really? About what?
I think we both know the answer to that, Buck.
I'm sorry, Mr. President, I'm not sure I do.
Admiral Talbot believes you recently lost a ship, or at least a ship licensed to carry your cargo.
Another pause.
I'm sorry, Mr. President.
That's news to me.
Ryan frowned.
Why in the hell would Logan lie about something like this?
Could Talbot be mistaken?
Not likely.
You sure, Buck? Believe me, if something happened to one of my shipments, I'd be madder than a scalded cat.
Interesting.
Well, I suppose Talbot's people might have got their wires crossed.
Sorry to bother you, Buck.
Never a bother, Mr. President. By the way, I'm really looking forward to the Andrews fundraiser on the 11th, if you can still make it.
Ryan didn't remember any fundraiser on the 11th, let alone one at Joint Base Andrews.
I'm sure it's on the calendar. I'll have Betty confirm later.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Take care of yourself, Buck.
You too, sir.
Logan rang off.
Ryan double-checked the calendar on his phone.
He was right.
There was no fundraiser at Andrews or on the 11th.
That meant Buck Logan was in trouble.
Chapter 11, Barcelona, Spain.
Jack grabbed a cab to the Guardia Civil Annex just west of the old city, a 10-minute walk from the famous Las Ramblas Boulevard, frequented by tourists and pickpockets from around the world. He passed by a small cafe with a single entrance, its steel door rolled up to let diners and sunshine into the half-dozen tables inside, all occupied, and crowded with people devouring churros and hot chocolate for breakfast. The restaurant was part of the same building that housed the Guardia Civil. Jack entered through a double-wide vehicle entrance gate and showed the security guard his passport before heading up to the second-story suite of offices, subleased to CNI. They had established a temporary presence in the city when the protests first began.
Jack, thanks so much for coming by, Brosa said, ushering him into her office. Her smile was pleasant enough, but she also looked exhausted, even fragile. Her shoulder holster and pistol hung on a coat rack behind her second-hand steel desk. Coffee? She pointed at the American-style coffee maker, quite unusual for Spain.
Sure.
She poured him a cup from a freshly brewed pot she had on a stand near her desk. Though Spartan, like almost every other government office he'd ever been in, the room, one of dozens inside the renovated 19th-century neoclassical building, had an old-world charm, with its high ceilings, bronze and glass light fixtures, and tall, heavy oaken doors. Jack was glad for the meeting and the hospitality, but he wanted to get down to business. The interrogation by Dellinger had already put him in a foul mood. If Dellinger was running the student exchange program, Jack would eat his Georgetown Hoyas sweatshirt. Dellinger was CIA, no doubt, and maybe even chief of station, judging by his age and demeanor. Now his bad mood was getting worse. It felt like the investigation was already behind schedule, and the longer it took to get things rolling, the less likely it was that Brosa or anybody would ever find the dirtbags that killed Renee. Brosa took a sip of her coffee.
So tell me, Jack, what exactly does a financial analyst do?
Nothing as interesting as what you do. A lot of reading, mostly corporate balance sheets, quarterly earnings reports, and crunching numbers. Pretty dull stuff.
You must be good at your job.
There's always room to improve. Your boss is a very important man, yes? Jerry Hendley is a brilliant investor and a former United States senator. He's been a great mentor to me. Jerry's name was better than an Amex black card when it came to impressing the right people.
Ah, that explains why I was told to cooperate with you as much as possible in this investigation.
Her voice dripped with resentment. Let me guess. Jerry is friends with your boss, or more likely, your boss's boss. Jack hadn't spoken to Jerry, but his boss's existing relationships and reputation were enough to open doors even here in Spain.
I was informed that Mr. Hendley has known the director of my agency for many years.
I just want to lend a hand, Ms. Brosa. Anything I can do to help solve Renee's case.
You do realize I can't divulge anything to you that would harm the Spanish national interest.
I wouldn't ask you to.
Good.
She pulled out a photograph from a file folder and handed it to Jack. It was the Bluetooth blonde.
Do you recognize this woman?
Jack nodded. Yeah, I do. She was standing on the far side of the bar yesterday.
Her name is Noelia Alexandri. She's a member of Brigada Catalan. Or was. She was killed in the blast. But this confirms who was behind the bombing.
Too bad she's dead. She could have given you more information. Strange that she got caught in the blast.
New terror groups always go through a learning phase when they become violent. Perhaps she accidentally detonated it.
She was on a Bluetooth the whole time she was there. Maybe you can find out who she was talking to.
There was no phone on her person.
What about the Bluetooth?
Brosa checked the notes on her phone. No Bluetooth either.
I know I saw the Bluetooth, and I know she was talking to someone.
Jack's jaw tightened, trying to keep his temper in check. He knew what he saw. Was she jerking his chain? Or were these Spanish police just careless idiots who couldn't run an evidence locker?
Or did someone take them?
Too bad. Brosa flashed an indulgent smile. Without that phone, we can't know who was on the other end, can we?
No, I guess not. Jack took another sip of coffee, his mind searching for answers.
He suddenly remembered the guy with the crooked nose outside in the street, also on a Bluetooth.
A coincidence, probably. Jack held up the photo.
Is this my copy to keep?
Of course.
I am cooperating with you, yes?
Not really. Jack pocketed the photo. Thanks.
Have you thought about tracking her movements over the last few days? Jack asked. It might lead you to where she bought the phone, and then you can access her account and find out who she was talking to.
Track her how?
Surely you guys have access to the city's traffic cameras.
Yes, of course. But I would have to convince my superior that the phone really did exist. Then he would have to convince somebody in the Barcelona traffic department to release the tapes. But then we'd have to get a court warrant to do so, since Miss Alexandri hasn't been charged with a crime, and such surveillance is considered a violation of personal privacy.
Jack took a sip of coffee to swallow his frustration. How long would all of that take?
Brosa snorted, a kind of laugh. This is España, and worse, Barcelona. My department represents the national government. We are already in a turf war with the local authorities. Imagine if a federal agent from Washington, D.C., asked for cooperation from a deputy sheriff in Alabama on the brink of your civil war.
Interesting reference, Jack thought. So, never, I take it.
Brosa shrugged as she put her cup back down.
No, not never.
But at least a week. Most likely two.
Can't you convince them that this is urgent?
She shook her head.
In my country, 2 weeks is urgent.
Jack glanced up at the painted tin-paneled ceiling, trying to come up with a different tack.
In a couple of weeks, a case like this would turn ice cold. The only chance of catching whoever did this was to grab them by the short hairs now, and preferably yesterday.
Have you had a chance to go over the CCTV footage from inside the restaurant?
Brosa's face narrowed. How do you know about these CCTV tapes?
I have eyes, don't I?
There were three cameras, each in one of the ceiling corners of the dining area. I wouldn't mind taking a look at them myself. Maybe I'll recognize somebody.
I didn't know financial analysts were so observant.
Don't blame me. My mother is an eye surgeon.
Brosa smiled. Tell me about your family.
He couldn't risk being too specific, even if it was just a friendly question, which he doubted. I have one older sister who's a doctor, like my mom, and two younger siblings, both still in high school. They're all brainiacs. I'm pretty sure I was adopted.
You have a big family.
And your father? Is he still alive?
By leaving his dad out, he only made him more obvious, Jack realized. Dumb mistake.
Oh, yeah. He and Mom are happily married. He was a history professor.
Which is why you love history, yes?
Probably.
He's retired.
No, he went to work for the government. He's kind of a bureaucrat. How about your family?
I am an only child. My mother died in a car wreck 10 years ago.
Her eyes reflexively turned toward the smartphone on her desk.
I'm so sorry.
I can't imagine getting a phone call like that.
Her eyes searched his face. You don't miss much, do you?
Well, I'm a people watcher.
Brosa's mouth pursed. She clearly didn't like that answer. She took a sip of coffee.
Yes, it was a terrible phone call. The worst. I was very close to my mother.
But such is life, yes? We are born to die. The goal is to live well while we can, don't you agree?
I do.
And your father?
He was a teacher too, like your father. He taught English for 20 years.
That's why your English is so good.
Perfect, actually.
Thank you. I try.
He is still with you, I hope.
Yes, thank God. He was a great teacher and a great father. I am very lucky.
If you don't mind my asking, why do you keep referring to him in the past tense?
Brosa's eyes suddenly clouded.
She turned in her chair, partly hiding her face as she wiped the corner of her eye with her fingers.
Jack stared at his hands, giving her a moment.
She took a deep breath and faced him again, snatching a napkin from the coffee tray.
My father taught English for 20 years, though it was his third language, and worked as a translator for the government for 10 years prior to that. But about a year ago, he just stopped speaking it. Whether he understands and pretends not to, I'm not sure.
I don't think so.
One time I had a friend at the office call him in English and tell him that his daughter had been rushed to the hospital and that he needed to come see her. You know, a little test. But my father kept repeating in Catalá that he didn't understand what my friend was saying. He said over and over, "I don't speak English." My friend believed him. The neurologist told me this is possible for a man in my father's condition.
Dementia. That must be hard on a linguist to lose a language like that. Brosis sat up, willing herself to stop the theatrics, wiping her proud, upturned nose with the napkin.
I don't think so. He doesn't seem frustrated at all when he hears it and doesn't understand it. And he doesn't try to speak it at all. It's almost as if he decided to bleach-pit that part of his brain. He is a proud Catalonian man, and Català is his first language, his heart language. It's who he most authentically is. Perhaps the death of English in his brain is just a function of his changing biochemistry, or perhaps he is merely retreating into what is most familiar and comfortable to him. Or perhaps it is a little of both.
Is his situation getting worse? She nodded, her eyes clouding again. I'm so sorry.
And that's why you dread your phone calls now.
Finding someone to care for him during the day while I'm at work is difficult.
He's becoming increasingly stubborn.
I'm always afraid the next call will tell me something terrible has happened to him. No family to help out.
He has a sister, but she lives in Australia with her family and has no wish to take him in. His brother is deceased.
It must be hard. She shrugged, but shook her head. It's not hard to love him or to care for him.
It's just our new normal.
But I have a job to do. I am a daughter. But I am also a patriot. Two loyalties, yes. Both equally important.
So, you understand?
She seemed surprised.
Jack did understand. He couldn't imagine how hard it would be to have to choose between serving his father or serving his country. He was lucky that the two were so perfectly aligned in his life.
My dad says that loyalty is destiny. Who and what we love determines the shape of our lives. But, like the man said, you can't serve two masters.
He was thinking about that a lot these days.
You can, but just not well, I'm afraid. They sat in silence for a moment. Jack was eager to push on, but she was still clearly decompressing. When she gathered herself together, she stood and refilled their coffee cups, signaling that she was back on track.
Anything else we need to talk about, Jack?
Jack flashed his best smile. Well, since you ask, I was wondering when you were going to let me see the CCTV tapes. Brosa nearly spit coffee out of her nose as she giggled.
I don't think that is going to be possible.
Why not? Maybe I can be of some use. Like you said, I'm observant.
I am afraid you cannot see them. It's official business.
But I was there, and I was nearly killed. Don't I have a right to see them?
It is my job to find the bombers, not yours. Unless you think you can do my job for me.
Me? No, not at all. I'm sorry if that's what you think I meant. I just genuinely want to help. Anything I can do to help find Renee's killers.
We found one already, Alexandre. We will find the rest, I assure you.
He heard the edge in her voice. He decided to back off and try to find another way in. Brosa beat him to the punch.
Miss Moore was a beautiful girl.
Very. And even smarter. And you knew her in college? Yes. We were friends.
A girl that smart and beautiful.
You were intimate with her.
He didn't see that one coming.
We were close for a while.
And you still have affection for her. Is that why you are so determined to find her killers?
Yes. Anything wrong with that?
Vale. I can understand that. But you must let me do my job.
Understood. Speaking of which, did you find out any information on this Samler guy?
Interesting you should ask.
Yes. I can share that with you. Brosa pulled out her phone. She opened her email and read from it.
In the last 5 days, there have been 3 Samlers in España. One is an American woman named Martha Samler. She arrived in Madrid 2 days ago on a Rick Steves tour and was in Toledo yesterday. She was never in the vicinity. Next, John Samler, a Canadian citizen, was in Barcelona yesterday morning. Today, he is in Tunis. She looked up from her phone. And he is an 11-year-old traveling with his maternal grandmother, Maria Busquets.
And the third,
Vale. That one is interesting. Karl Sammler, a German businessman from Dusseldorf. He was traveling in Spain, but we don't have any records of his travel destinations. We cannot be sure if he was in Barcelona until we speak with him. He is back in Germany now, and my office in Madrid is sending an agent to speak with him this afternoon. You'll keep me informed, if it is related to the case. Thank you. I'm curious, Jack. You said you came to Spain to study the Spanish Civil War. What did you learn?
Do you want the long answer or the short one?
How about both?
Chapter 12. Jack leaned back in his chair, folding his hands in his lap like a college professor, a gesture he'd accidentally picked up from his dad.
Okay. The shortest version is this. Most politicians suck. Brosa snort laughed again. Hard to argue with that. The less short version reminds me of a line in Anthony Beaver's book, The Battle for Spain. Yes, I know it. It was a huge bestseller here. He said the Spanish Civil War was the only war in which the losers got to write the history. And he's right. In the West, we saw that war as purely good versus evil. Freedom-loving Republicans fighting a hopeless war against Franco's unbeatable fascists. A real David versus Goliath story. If Americans know anything about that war, it's based on the book or the movie For Whom the Bell Tolls. Do you know it?
Hemingway. Sans dubte.
Without a doubt. I love it. It is both terribly romantic and tragic, which is very Spanish. It wasn't an accident Gary Cooper got cast for that film. He's an actor who played a lot of American cowboys. The whole movie plays like a Western. We Americans love underdogs. The Republicans play the role of the helpless peasants fighting shoulder to shoulder with the International Brigades for Democracy. They're up against Franco's fascist war machine, backed by Hitler's Condor Legion and Mussolini's Blackshirts.
Which was true.
Which was true. But not the whole truth. The Republicans fought the fascists, yes, but they were also murdering each other. The Spanish Stalinists were the worst. Their goal was to advance the interests of the Soviet Union, not Spain, and they imprisoned and killed the Spanish communists and anarchists who actually wanted a real socialist revolution here.
Crimes were committed by both sides, though far worse by the fascists.
Agreed. But that's only the tip of the iceberg. It's the contradictions of that war that tell me the most about it.
Which contradictions?
Franco claimed to be fighting for Catholicism, but his crack troops were Rifian Muslims. He also claimed to be fighting for Spanish nationalism, but his military campaign relied heavily on German and Italian troops and arms to win. At the same time, the Republican loyalists claimed to be fighting for freedom and democracy against fascism, while they were murdering priests and nuns, burning churches, and slaughtering their political opponents. Worse, all of their material support came from Stalin, the most murderous tyrant in modern European history.
I'm impressed. You know a lot about our history. It was a very difficult and confusing time for us. In my own family, one side fought for the Republic and the other side fought for Franco. I even had a grandfather who fought with the División Azul in Leningrad for Hitler. But he was no Nazi and no fascist. He was just a poor man who couldn't find any other way to feed his empty stomach. He used to joke how expensive the terrible German rations were.
The Germans made him pay for his rations?
No, the Russians did. He lost his left eye to shrapnel and three fingers of his right hand to frostbite.
She laughed. That never stopped him from sleeping with many beautiful women. The bottom line for me is that it seems like a lot of what's going on in Barcelona right now is still connected to the Civil War.
Brosa nodded. Yes, it is. The independence issue was important for us before La Guerra, and it was never fully resolved. And really, neither was the war itself. Do you know that there are still 200,000 Spaniards lying in unmarked graves from the Civil War? Can you imagine such a thing in civilized Europe?
Yeah, I can. Jack's mind drifted back again to the slaughter of the Yugoslavian Civil Wars, and every other Holocaust that had swept the continent since the 30 Years' War. Civilized Europe has been a slaughterhouse since before they invented the word Europe. The reason Europeans have dominated the globe for the last 5 centuries is because they have a particular genius for organized violence.
You sound like a history professor.
I imagine, just like your father.
Jack wasn't sure what to do with that comment, so he ignored it.
The Spanish Civil War reminded me that history repeats itself.
In what way?
When the people believe the justice system is no longer just, that the politicians are about the laws they make, that the government serves the interests of the ruling class instead of the middle and working classes, and when the history and culture and language of the people are denigrated and denied, these are the conditions that make a society ripe for civil war.
You have just described the feelings of millions of Catalonians, Brossa said as she took her last sip of coffee.
Not just here. It's a movement sweeping all over the world, and I suspect it might even change the world, sooner rather than later.
For better or for worse?
The jury's still out on that one.
Brossa's phone vibrated, a voicemail. She checked it, frowning.
Worried, Jack was certain. Something personal. Please, take it, he said.
Excuse me. She listened to the message.
Whatever she was hearing, a woman's anxious voice was all Jack could make out, darkened Brosa's face. She deleted the message. Everything okay?
I hate cell phones.
She tossed it on the table like it was a dirty diaper. She began rubbing her forehead, stressed, gathering her thoughts. Maybe I should go. Jack stood.
Yes, thank you. Brossa stood too. I will call you when I learn of anything. When are you leaving for home?
Not until I'm satisfied Renee got her justice. Brossa reached for her shoulder holster and slipped it on. She gave him a pitying look.
This is España, Jack. You might be here for a long while.
Chapter 13.
Jack left through the Guardia Civil's double-wide gate and turned toward the little cafe next door. The place was still jumping, but something about the college-age kid sitting near the door bothered him. Slacks, shirt, tie. Not a tourist. Jack turned into the cafe, grabbed an empty chair from the next table, and sat down next to the kid, startling him. An empty chocolate-smeared demitasse cup and a plate littered with churro crumbles were on the table in front of him.
What's your story? Jack asked. Perdón, señor.
Jack shook his head, pointed at his left hand. Not a lot of Spaniards wear Texas Aggie class rings. The kid reflexively raised his ring hand and stared at it.
Wow, good catch.
So who are you? Who sent you? And why are you following me?
Name's Sam Davis. I was in the break room at the consulate when Mr. Dellinger grabbed me and told me to follow you.
Why?
He said to just keep an eye on you and report back what I found.
And what did you find?
That you came to the Guardia Civil building, stayed about 20 minutes and left.
Jack leaned closer, lowered his voice. Look, Sam, no offense, but you kind of suck at being a spy.
I'm not a spy. I'm here on a semester internship with the Office of Agricultural Affairs. I'm an international business major. But when Mr. Dellinger says go, you go.
He's your boss.
Not exactly. He runs the student exchange programs, but he's a pretty big deal around the consulate. He and the CG spend a lot of time together.
Well, head back to your office and tell Mr. Dellinger you followed me here and you saw me leave. Got it?
Got it.
Jack stood and snatched up the bill for Davis's breakfast. Next time, try the pancakes.
And if I ever see you again?
Davis stood.
You won't.
Good. Jack watched the kid slink away. Davis was almost the same age he was when he joined the campus. He couldn't help but grin.
Was I ever really that green?
Jack pulled out his wallet, but it was empty. He put the kid's bill on his credit card instead. He decided to head back to his place and see what he could dig up on the dead bomber on his own, hoping like hell Noelia Alexandri was her real name, while he waited for Gavin's call. Lost in his thoughts, he didn't see Crooked Nose following far behind him,
shielded by a Chinese tour group.
Jack sat on the rooftop terrace of his apartment. It was a warm day with a slight breeze from the sea. The building itself contained several other apartments, but Jack's had exclusive access to the terrace through a separate stairwell. It had become his favorite thing about the place, with views of both the Mediterranean to the south and the old city to the north. It even had a great internet connection. At night, he could see the lights from the basilica on the high mountain north of Barcelona. The terrace had a stout table and chairs that sat beneath a sturdy aluminum awning frame, though the awning itself was nowhere to be seen. It didn't matter. The sun was warm and welcoming this time of year, not a beatdown like it could be in the summer, according to the travel books he'd read. The dead bomber's name and face appeared in the Spanish-language newspapers, and as far as Jack could tell with his poor Spanish, all of them reported essentially the same terse information, probably from the same press release that authorities sent out on a case like this. Noelia Alexandri was 23 years old at the time of her death. She had been a journalism major at the Universitat de Vic, a small city up north near the Pyrenees where she was born, before dropping out 2 years ago. She had been a student activist involved with the independence movement while in school, but never violent and never arrested for anything criminal, according to her grieving mother. Too bad, Jack thought. A bright young woman with a promising future, blown to hell by her own negligence. Or someone else's. It was the someone else that really interested him. Getting hold of her cell phone would open that door, and Gavin was just the guy to do it. Time for a phone call. He headed back downstairs to the relative security of his apartment. No telling who might overhear his conversation with Gavin about the bombing, and draw the wrong conclusions.
Chapter 14.
Jack, that's so weird. I was just about to call you. You won't believe the stuff I found.
Gavin's high-pitched voice squealed with the enthusiasm of a teenage gamer winning a Fortnite competition. But the portly 50-something bachelor, who actually was a Fortnite player, was a world-class programmer, hacker, and researcher, and the brains behind Hendley Associates' considerable IT department. Surprised me.
Well, where should I start? I'll do the good stuff first. Your friend's company, Crowdscope? It's a CIA op, and Rene Moore was CIA.
What? You're sure?
Hello? It's me. Of course I'm sure.
Jack couldn't believe it.
Moore had never mentioned government service. The one time he'd raised it with her, she'd laughed in his face, incredulous.
Where's the money in that, Jack? He wondered what had changed her mind. On the other hand, Silicon Valley made perfect sense as a CIA station. Google, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the other giant social media networks constituted the most successful intelligence-gathering operation the world had ever seen. They collected and dissected terabytes of personal data from their billions of users around the world, almost always provided by the users themselves, and with their own consent.
Why try to compete with that kind of data harvesting and analysis when you could simply infiltrate those pre-existing networks?
Thanks to Snowden, everybody knew that the intelligence community had secured the cooperation of many of the technology firms early on. Companies like Google, Amazon, and Microsoft had billions of dollars worth of contracts with the federal government, including the agencies of the intelligence community and the Department of Defense. But a combination of bad press, customer concerns, and activist outrage had resulted in a pushback against covert and even overt cooperation by these firms with the American government. These companies' loyalties were to their bottom lines, not national security. It wasn't surprising that the CIA had decided to try to find another way in. God knows how many foreign powers used platforms like Facebook and Twitter to covertly influence domestic and world opinion. If he ran the CIA, Jack would focus his efforts on infiltrating and influencing Silicon Valley as well. What can you tell me about Renee? What was she doing at Crowdscope or in Barcelona?
That's the crazy thing, Jack. I have access to a lot of databases, including ones I'm not supposed to have access to. But whatever your friend was up to,
and whatever operations CrowdScope is conducting, I can't get close to it. I think even their firewalls have firewalls. I tried tiptoeing around some of their defenses and set off a few alarms. If I'm not careful, I'm going to get hauled away by a CIA snatch team and dumped in an offshore prison somewhere. So Renee wasn't just in federal service, Jack thought. She was all the way in, up to her neck. If CrowdScope is that important, and if Renee was part of it, whatever she was up to in Barcelona must be kryptonite. Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Gavin asked. Jack heard paper crinkling. Snickers or Almond Joy? Snickers, baby. Gavin took a bite and spoke with a full mouth. It's the power bar of gamers everywhere. So I'm thinking the bombing in Barcelona wasn't a terror act at all. Maybe the real target was Renee. What about you? A definite maybe. But Jack, there is one other possibility. What's that? Maybe the real target was you. Why me? Why not you? Besides the fact you work for Jerry Hendley and you're the son of the President of the United States, a fact we've managed to hide, but it's still a fact that someone could have discovered. You've killed, captured, or jailed enough bad guys on your own in the last few years to put you on a dozen hit lists. Remember Van Delden? The Iron Syndicate? Jack surely did. The Iron Syndicate was an international crime organization with tentacles reaching into almost every security organization on the planet. They'd put a bounty on Jack's head, or technically, for the collection of his severed head 2 years ago. Thanks to his time in Poland with Liliana, the Iron Syndicate was largely dismantled and its members dead, in jail or on the run. God rest your soul, Liliana. I appreciate the thought, Gav. But I'd be really surprised if they were after me. I've been wide open the whole time I've been in Spain. There were dozens of better opportunities to take me out without any collateral damage. Collateral damage is a great way to hide a crime, you know. I think you're reaching. Just keeping an eye out for you. I appreciate that, more than you know. But it seems to me that Renee is the obvious target. As near as I can tell, she'd only just arrived in Barcelona. Maybe you can find out when and where she flew in from. That might give us a clue as to her assignment. Sure thing. Thanks. You said you had other stuff you've discovered besides Moore's CIA connection? Oh, yeah, I almost forgot. I was thinking about the CCTV tape. Any luck with your CNI contact?
I tried. No go.
Well, no worries on that account. I hacked their server.
You did what? How?
Oh, Jack. I'm hurt.
You doubted me?
Jack shouldn't have been surprised. Gavin was a one-man wrecking machine when it came to hacking. Even NSA-level encryption didn't stop him. He usually found his way around technological firewalls by exploiting the failings of the human operators. Gavin idolized the Israeli agents who destroyed the centrifuges at the Natanz nuclear facility. They did it by dropping a Stuxnet-infested flash drive on the ground, knowing that an OCD Iranian scientist would pick it up and insert it into one of the air-gapped computers. I never doubt you, Gavin. You only managed to astound me. Oh, you know, all in a day's work. Jack rolled his eyes. Gavin's gloating practically oozed through the phone. So what did you find on the CCTV tapes? I only had time to download an hour's worth before their IT people discovered I was snooping around. I know you know this, but there's a video editing software on the secure Hendley cloud server you can use to check out what I downloaded, along with some facial recognition software that might help. Gavin had built an entire suite of proprietary investigative tools that members of the campus could access remotely for occasions just like this. Gavin was more than happy to do the work himself, but usually there was far more of it to do than even an extraordinary technician like Gavin could handle. He not only built the suite of tools, he trained the team on them as well. They couldn't come close to Gavin's talent on the really technical stuff. But for grunt work like reviewing hours of video or audio transmissions, it was better to put less skilled hands on the oars. Gavin, I can't believe it. That's perfect. Post it up on the Hendley Cloud as soon as you can, and I'll start going through it.
Gavin's mouth was full of Snickers bar again.
Already done.
Okay, okay. You're obviously one step ahead of me. That goes without saying. Then let me throw you a curveball. I'm sending you something now. Jack texted the photo of the Bluetooth blonde Brosa gave him and links to the stories he'd found about her. He gave Gavin a minute to look it over.
Sounds like you already know who she is. What do you need from me?
I saw her at the restaurant just before it blew. She was on a phone. My bet is that it's a burner phone. The CNI says they don't have it.
They might be lying.
Could be. But for now, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt. Any chance you can break into the citywide camera system and track her movements? If she bought that phone herself, you might be able to find the store where she got it. From there, we might be able to run her down.
Yeah, that'll be fun.
I've got a new automated tracking software I wrote that I want to try out. It lets the computer do all of the monotonous stuff.
Thanks, Gav.
I couldn't do this without you.
No question about that.
So you said that you had some bad news.
Oh, yeah, I nearly forgot.
I chased down this Samler guy you asked me to look into. I couldn't come up with anybody who had any obvious ties to Moore.
Sorry about that.
Don't sweat it. My Spanish source came up short, too. Though apparently there was a German national by that name in Spain a few days ago, and she's chasing him down.
I saw him, too. Already checked him out. He's not the guy.
Are you sure you heard the name right?
Could she have said Samuels, maybe? Or Statler, something like that?
I heard it right. Renee made sure of that.
I don't mean to offend you, but maybe she was hallucinating toward the end, or losing oxygen to her brain. She might have said Samler, but that might not mean anything at all.
It's a possibility. Jack's hopes began to fade. Unless the Spaniards pull up something on Samler. I'm afraid he's a dead end for now.
Chapter 15. Washington, D.C. Diplomatic Reception Room. The White House.
Show him in, please. Arnie Van Damme, the president's chief of staff, cradled the phone, then stifled a yawn. His suit was rumpled from a long day that always began before Ryan's, and Ryan always started early.
Can I get you a cup of coffee?
Ryan smiled.
Or maybe a can of Ensure.
Arnie wiped a smudge off his rimless glasses with his tie.
Did I ever tell you that my old man used to work the graveyard shift at the steel mill to make extra money so he could put me through college so I wouldn't have to work late nights?
You call this work?
Ryan pointed at the elegant federal period room around them. The two old friends sat on gold silk wingback chairs in front of a roaring fireplace, with the iconic Gilbert Stuart portrait of George Washington hanging over the mantel. The panoramic wallpaper surrounding the room had been installed by Jacqueline Kennedy, and every important president, prime minister, and potentate from the last 50 years had either stood or sat in this room at some point. Ryan was in a pair of jeans, Sperry topsiders, and a fly navy sweatshirt, having come straight down from the family residence. He was already in bed and propped up on his pillows next to Kathy, and only a few pages into Lieutenant Colonel Rip Rawlings' latest when Arnie called 40 minutes ago. He wasn't all that surprised by the call, but grew concerned when Arnie told him Buck Logan was actually on his way over. Ryan assumed he'd be getting a call from the big Texan. He wasn't expecting a personal visit.
"Must be damned important," Arnie said.
Ryan agreed. The phone call with Logan that morning was odd, to say the least. When Ryan had asked Logan about his sunken ship, he denied it happened. According to Admiral Talbot, that was a lie. And then Logan insisted on mentioning the non-existent Andrews fundraiser. Not a lie so much as a statement that was demonstrably false. It took about a heartbeat and a half for Ryan to figure out Logan's coded message.
I just told you an obvious lie about the fundraiser so that we both know I'm lying, and that way, you know I just lied to you about the sunken ship. And that's how Ryan knew Logan was in trouble. Given the dramatic meeting about to happen, he assumed that meant big trouble. Ryan had given Arnie a heads up about Logan while he was still in transit from Walter Reed, Arnie was almost always the first call Jack made when the excrement hit the oscillator, because his chief of staff was about the sharpest pencil in the drawer as far as politics was concerned. Arnie had been chief of staff to 3 presidents, including him from the beginning. The crow's feet around Arnie's pale blue eyes were deeper, and his bald scalp a little paler and flakier than when he'd first met the man. But Arnie's mind hadn't aged. Arnie might have looked a little like Merkin Muffley, the hapless American president in Dr. Strangelove, but he was General Chesty Puller when it counted on the political battlefield, and Ryan couldn't ask for more than that. It was Arnie's suggestion to meet in the diplomatic reception room rather than the Oval. It was nearer the family residence, so Jack wouldn't have to walk so far at the late hour, and it was still on the first floor for Logan's convenience. As always. Arnie thought of everything. One of the double doors opened, and an electric wheelchair rolled into the room. Jack and Arnie stood as Buck Logan wheeled in their direction. Ryan watched Logan's bodyguard, a 6'5" slab of meat in a tailored suit, take a position outside next to the PPD agents stationed there before the door closed again. "Mr. President, I'm so terribly sorry to inconvenience you," Logan said as he pulled to a stop. He removed his gray felt Stetson. His bright blue eyes contrasted with his thick but short-cropped silver hair. He was 5 years younger than Ryan, but the deep lines in his rugged face aged him considerably. "I knew you had the smarts to figure out what I was trying to tell you, and I can't thank you enough for allowing me to inconvenience you at this ridiculous hour." Ryan smiled. "It's a little past Arnie's bedtime, but I think it all worked out." Ryan shook Logan's hand. The Texan's grip was crushing. The former Naval Academy tight end had been nearly as big as his bodyguard when he played football. Tragically, a catastrophic spinal cord injury from a late hit by Notre Dame in his senior year put him in a wheelchair forever, ending both his collegiate football career and his dream of following in his father's footsteps into military service. As physically impressive as he still was, Buck Logan's greatest strength was his first-rate mind. His father had built a great regional trucking firm after the Korean War, but it was Buck who transformed it into a global logistics operation, with land, sea, and air assets. To satisfy his longing for military service, Logan had also built a top-tier private military contracting outfit. Altogether, Buck had forged White Mountain Logistics plus Security into one of the largest and most reliable private sector contractors servicing the DoD and several other federal departments. But despite his outsized achievements in business and academics, he finished his USNA degree in civil engineering with a 4.0. Buck still lived in the long shadow of his famous father. Logan nodded at Arnie. "Then my apologies to you as well, Mr. Van Damme. Please, it's just Arnie." "Can I get you something to eat? Drink?" Ryan asked. "No, sir, I've already put you out. I'll be brief." Logan motioned to the 2 empty wingback chairs. "Please, don't stand on my account." Jack and Arnie took their seats. "So, Buck, what's this all about?" Ryan asked. Logan sat up straighter in his motorized chair. "First of all, let me get it off my chest. As you've already figured out, I lied to you this afternoon, Mr. President, and I can hardly forgive myself for that. But the truth of the matter is, I didn't have much of a choice. I'm in one hell of a pickle, and I'm afraid my personal security situation is being compromised. I just didn't feel comfortable speaking with you on an unsecured line. Lucky for me, I own a fleet of private planes, so arranging an unscheduled flight up here wasn't a problem. And I wanted to look you in the eye when we spoke. I can appreciate that, Buck. So, let's get to it. What's going on?" "The bottom line is that one of my ships, technically a ship I was leasing for a single transport, was sunk 7 days ago in the South Pacific." "Why lie about it?" Arnie asked. Logan reached around behind his chair, pulled a file folder out of his seat pocket, and handed a couple of email printouts to Arnie. "As you can read there, that sinking was no accident. I was sent that note 72 hours before it happened. I was told to transfer $10 million in Bitcoin to a dark web address, or else they'd sink one of my shipments.
What concerns me is that they must have known it wasn't my ship, only my cargo. Not many people have that information. And that's why you believe there's someone on the inside of your organization, and why you couldn't speak on the phone. Logan grinned. That's why I'm your biggest supporter in Texas, Mr. President. Sharp as a tack and blunt as a hammer. Why didn't you contact us when you received this threat? Arnie asked. Logan laughed. Are you kidding me? What was I going to do? Come crying to you guys because somebody said something mean to me? A non-specific, non-credible threat. What could you have done to prevent it? I've got operations all over the globe. It's not like you were going to put marine detachments on all of my ships or provide me with destroyer escorts. Besides, for all I know, this was sent by some Nigerian princess riding a laptop somewhere in Romania. Logan blew air through his bleached white teeth, his face reddening. Nobody's gonna push Buck Logan around. Sure in hell ain't gonna squeeze 10 million U.S. government dollars out of his wallet with a goddamn email. Jack and Arnie exchanged a look. Logan was losing it right in front of them. Logan saw their reaction. Sorry about that, gentlemen. I'm a little off my game, as you can well imagine. I lost $17 million worth of civilian cargo. Mostly drilling pipe, steel fittings, generators. Nothing for Uncle Sam, mind you. Not to mention the poor bastards who went down with the ship, whoever they were. You have insurance, don't you? Flip over to the second page. After the sinking, I was contacted again. Told in no uncertain terms, do not contact your insurance and do not contact the authorities or more sinkings will follow. Given the circumstances, I was inclined to believe them. Logan pointed at the pages again. You can see there, they listed out every one of my scheduled shipments for the next 30 days and each one of my flagged vessels. I lose a few more of those, and I'm ruined, no matter what I do. If I don't file insurance claims on the Jade Star cargo, I'm out of pocket on the losses. And if I do file a claim, my insurance rates will skyrocket, and then these bastards said they'd sink another one. If they sank a second boat, I'd have to file a second claim, and then my insurance would get canceled. And if that happens, then I can't carry goods, and I'm out of business. Either way, my pooch is royally screwed. What are you going to do now? Cross my fingers and pray. 3 days ago, they sent me another letter demanding $20 million. 10 for the first letter and 10 for not believing them. What did you do? Arnie asked. I paid the bastards. What else could I do? Have they threatened any more of your ships? No. They said this was a one-time payment. Arnie pressed further. And you actually believe them? Whoever these shitheads are, they're smart. I doubt I'm the first one they've done this to, and probably not the last. It's one thing to swipe a few apples from the neighbor's tree, but there's no point in cutting it down, because then the apples run out. You don't know how right you are, Buck. There have been several other unexplained sinkings along with yours, Ryan said. I'll be damned. They must have been threatened the same way you were, Arnie said. Same conditions. Logan's eyes narrowed. Who else have they hit? Big companies with deep pockets like yours. All in the Pacific, just like yours. And they haven't said anything either. No. You've told us the most. And that wasn't a hell of a lot, Ryan said. He leaned forward. No idea at all who's behind this. Logan shifted around in his chair. I've thought long and hard on this. Could be a political group. Could be a religious outfit. Or it might just be your run-of-the-mill, greedy-ass pirate. They all have the same motive. Money. The question is, what do they want to do with that money? Something tells me you've ruled all of those out, Ryan said. Motive ain't enough. You gotta have the means, which tells me we're talking about a blue water navy. As I've noodled on it, I think we're talking about the Russians. Why the Russians? Arnie asked. That seems like a real stretch. Is it? The South Pacific is a far piece out in the middle of nowhere. Who else has the reach? North Korea has a navy, but mostly coastal vessels, and their deep water stuff is mostly secondhand Cold War crap from the Russians. China has the reach, but it's all tangled up in Hong Kong right now, and their navy is playing footsie with us in the South China Sea. And last I heard, there sure as hell ain't no flip-flop-wearing Somali pirates running around in the Cook Islands. Logan leaned forward. But the Ruskies have 8 deep-water surface vessels and 18-plus submarines just in their Pacific fleet. Hell, they got more subs in their navy than we do. I'll grant you they have the means, Ryan said. But what's their motive? That's what I can't quite figure out. Maybe they've had some kind of breakthrough in their underwater operations, or their hypersonic anti-ship missiles, and they're running real-world tests. Any Russian-flagged ship sunk? No. Ryan wondered if Logan was onto something. Not U.S.-flagged or Chinese-flagged, either. But you're missing the obvious, Buck. They hit you up for cash, Arnie said. That's not a military operation. Are you kidding me? Russia is run by the world's richest gangsters. They love money. The dirtier, the better. What better way to hide their testing program than to pretend it's a piracy operation and make some serious bank on the side doing it? Ryan and Arnie exchanged another look. Maybe Logan wasn't crazy after all. You said you think you have an insider on your hands. What are you doing about it? Arnie asked. Logan shifted around in his chair again, unable to get comfortable. It was obviously a losing battle. I've got my most trusted security people sniffing around to find out who the backstabbing some bitch is. But no luck so far. Arnie held up the black